You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon. I have the real honor and pleasure today of welcoming my friend General Laurie Robinson back to Brookings, and I'm glad you're all here to join us. Laurie Robinson was a lieutenant colonel when she first came to Brookings in 2001. We had the great pleasure of spending a year with her in her mid-career military education, which is always more of an education for us here at Brookings to have the military fellows than for them, but created a friendship and sort of a fan club here at Brookings that continued over the years as she rose through the ranks. I think a lot of you know her story, and we're going to talk about her story a little bit this morning before we also get into some of her observations on strategic issues before the country, and then have time for your thoughts and questions as well. And also, I'm very happy that this is happening during Christmas season because, and holiday season more generally, I feel like I've already gotten my Christmas wish in getting the chance to welcome Laurie Robinson back. And I think her story, since we're lucky enough to have C-SPAN coverage today, for those who want to watch It's a Wonderful Life and may not want the Jimmy Stewart version, you got just as good of a version here with General Robinson's amazing story. She was from an Air Force family, but chose not to go to the Air Force Academy herself, went to the University of New Hampshire, but Air Force ROTC. And then, this is, by the way, a couple of years ago, even though she looks about 35, she's actually a couple of years older than that. So this is back in the 1980s. And then was commissioned an officer, became what's called an air battle manager, which, as I've heard it described, is the person who tells the F-15 pilots where they can go, so to speak. But it literally is the person who does that. And she moved up through the ranks, was the first woman ever at the Nellis Fighter Weapons School, which is the real Top Gun school, because it's the Air Force version of Top Gun. So if you're looking for the real sort of Tom Cruise and Demi Moore, G.I. Jane, this is the real thing right here in terms of the first one who did that, as well as many other accomplishments throughout her career. I think all of you know that she was one of the very few, roughly half dozen women ever in the U.S. military's history so far to attain the rank of four-star general, which happened around 2014, I believe, when she pinned on four stars and had her first position with that rank as the Air Component Commander at Pacific Command. She had previously been, by the way, Vice Wing Commander for the 405th Expeditionary Wing and deployed to the Middle East and had a lot of combat experience, therefore, in the broader Iraq, Afghanistan, and CENTCOM theater. So she's really seen a lot of the world in her various roles. And on top of that, as you all know, she finished her military career as the first woman in American history to lead a combatant command when she ran Northern Command and NORAD from 2016 to 2018. Those of you who were doing the math may recall that that period is also when Kim Jong-un was launching his ICBM tests and when President Trump and Kim Jong-un had not yet become such good buddies. So there was quite a bit of tension in the relationship, and she was the one responsible for protecting the country in the event of a North Korean ICBM attack against North America. On top of that, if that wasn't enough, she then had to manage the military assistance to broader civilian authority efforts as the three big hurricanes hit in the fall of 2017 or 2017 as well. And so anyway, we're going to talk a lot more about her career, but without further ado, please join me in welcoming General Laurie Robinson back to Brookings.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. He's too generous. He's way too generous with his compliments.
Pretty sure everything I said was just a fact, not even trying to be complimentary, although, again, I'm just thrilled. So I guess what I'd like to do, if we could, I'll try not to call you Laurie too much because you deserve the title General Robinson, and it's really a remarkable story that all of us can be inspired by. But it couldn't have been easy throughout any point in your career as a woman. And I want to bring you back to the early days especially and start there and just describe a little bit of how it was to decide to join the military as a woman and then in the early years of working your way up through the ranks in a very macho culture, which it still is today, I think. How did you handle that and what were the big challenges and what were some of your sort of, insights or personal methods of dealing with that culture?
So Michael's right. My dad was in the Air Force. At 18 years, I'm the oldest of five. From the oldest to the youngest is 6 years. And my dad's sitting there looking at the fact that he's going to have to pay for college for five kids. And he's like, hey, Lori, why don't you go to the Air Force Academy? And I was like, absolutely not. I've been in the Air Force for 18 years, and I'm ready to do something else. And he goes, well, where would you like to go to college? And I said, well, the University of Texas, Hook'em Horns. And he said, uh-huh, I'm paying. You're going to the University of New Hampshire because it's our state of residence. And so I was going to be an English major, a teacher. But the first year, I was so happy to be out of home. My grades might have suffered just a little bit. So I decided to become an English major, and the teaching you were going to have to take a fifth year. So I'm like, what am I going to do with this? So I decided to join ROTC because I thought, well, 4 years and that'll be good. When I got what my job was, air battle manager, the guy in charge of our detachment said, Lori, talk to your father. You need to get out of this. You'll never get promoted. And I thought, well, I'm not going to ask my dad to do anything. I'm in it, and I'm in it by myself. So luckily enough, as Michael mentioned, you know, I had the privilege to be part of an initial squadron at the fighter weapons school, the best institution, and I was the first female instructor there. But I will tell you, when you ask things somebody about what molds you, that was probably one of the places that really molded me. That's the place that taught me about being part of a team. That's the place, because you would brief with the pilots, you would execute with the pilots, you would debrief with the pilots, you would hang around together. But more importantly, I think the biggest lesson I learned there, we had a boss, our boss was awesome. And he said to us, you realize you're a part of something bigger than yourself. And I thought, what is he talking about? You know? And it was over time that I realized that it wasn't about me, that it was about the institution. And so that place, that time, really molded me. And just for context sake, my husband's sitting up here. He was at Nellis Air Force Base at the same time, and that's where we met. He flew for the Thunderbirds. And then a very dear friend of mine, retired Lieutenant General. My husband's a retired two-star, a retired Lieutenant General, Dash Jameson. She was the second female instructor at the Fighter Weapons School, and she wrote the entire syllabus for her discipline of intelligence. And so I would tell you, as a woman there, I thrived because it wasn't about being a woman. It was about getting the task done. It was about being very competent at what I did and trying to be the best at what I did. When you walk into a room, though, and you realize you're the only woman in the room, you become very self-aware of that. But what I realized in that community, and it was all fighter pilots, was what they cared about was you being good at what you did. That's what was important. And so from that, you know, I would tell you, if you went through my career, you know, and it was in what we call the combat air forces. So it was fighter pilots. I flew on the back of AWACS on Joint Stars. It was understanding, one, that it isn't about you. It is about the institution. Two, the more that you can teach people that work with you and work for you to be better than you, when you leave the institution, hopefully you've left it better than when you got there. And so when I got to my first flying unit, my career field at the time was one of those career fields that what we would say ate their young. And my goal was to make it everybody to realize that they were a part of something bigger than themselves. And so over my career, I've tried very hard to teach. I would always say, you know, to my subordinate commanders or other commanders, say, as long as it's not illegal, immoral, or unethical, let's learn from whatever experience it was. And so I think that shaping at Nellis Air Force Base as a young one, and understanding about the team effort, and understanding that you're a part about something bigger than yourself, was really, really made me a different human being. As I increased in rank, was a two-star in Qatar, was a three-star at Langley Air Force Base, and then a four-star in the Pacific and out in Colorado. You know, the notion that I was a woman, and I am, That notion, you know, that would be the headline that people would say. And my headline was this. My headline was, I'm a commander, I'm a general, I'm an airman, and I just happen to be a woman. And if I make the woman more important than all those other things, then I've done disrespect to the institution. I do realize that I have done things that other women haven't. I do realize, as Michael said, the first ever female combatant commander, and I recognize that. And I realize that I have a lot of time, a lot of people watching what I do. And I take that on, too. But I don't want the woman to be the headline. I want the commander to be the headline. And so I've just tried all the time, Michael, to be a team player, to be the best at everything, any job anybody ever gave me, and to make those around me better than me.
Did it get easier or harder as you rose through the ranks being a woman? Did you reach a sort of atmosphere and ambience and a group of people where it became more natural for them to think of you as all the things you said? Or did it in some ways become harder? I'm curious. I've never asked you this question before.
Yeah.
But
I said to Michael, be nice. Anyway, so here's what I discovered. In my circle in the Air Force and with the friends that I grew up with, it was a non-event. You know, it was, well, that's just Lori. You know, Lori's doing what Lori does. And for them, you know, in fact, you know, I had very dear friends that I was a 4-star with and a 3-star with and a 2-star with. And so for them, that was like, that didn't matter. It was interesting, and this isn't meant negatively, but it was interesting now with the other services, because there aren't as many general officers, female general officers, in the other services. So I felt I tried harder because in my circle, everybody knew me. So there wasn't, they knew what I was capable of. They trusted me. I trusted them. I put extra energy when I entered a new job that was joint, as an example, in Qatar. So going to Qatar for a year as the deputy air component commander. I didn't know General Mattis at all, you know, and now I'm working for General Goldfein, but when General Goldfein's not there, you know, General Mattis is there. And so I worked extra hard to quickly build the trust. I never ever felt that people were didn't trust me, but I wanted to earn that very quickly. Just because I was different, you know. I'll tell you a story. I went to China and met the Chinese air chief, and you know he and I was a 4-star, and you know, again, it's a different culture, right? And so, you know, it's that, how do you build that trust as quickly as you can and know, hey, I'm here, you know, as the commander of Pacific Air Forces. I just happen to be a woman. So because I was different, and because it wasn't in different services and countries, I put a lot of pressure on myself to make sure that I kept everything on an even playing field, and I'm here to do a job.
Now, as air battle manager, maybe just a little bit on that, because I like to explore what that means for a crowd on television and here watching and learning about the military. Can you tell us, you were involved not only in the air-to-air element, but the air-to-ground, the ground attack piece of that, right? Mm-hmm. And so you and your colleagues were mapping the entire orchestration, the entire choreography of a concerted effort that involved everything from electronic warfare aircraft, dogfighting aircraft, ground attack aircraft, the whole enchilada put together. Is that right?
That's right. So let me give this crowd looks kind of old enough to give you my first analogy. Top Gun, okay, that's the second weapons school. But Top Gun, if you remember at the end of Top Gun with the round scope and the guys talking to Maverick, and he's telling them where the bogeys are, right? Everybody, can I get a couple nods? Yeah? Okay, good. So that's what I did. So I was talking to everybody, the fighter pilots and the pilots out on the radio, one, to tell them where the bad guys are, two, to ensure that the guys that were going to help them drop the bombs to put on target, you know, they had a path to go do that. We also worried about the orchestration of tankers, you know, where they could get gas and all that stuff. Worried about other orchestration to ensure that the Joint Force Commander's objectives were met. So that whatever was asked of us, that we knew what we had to do to ensure that those objectives were met. And often, because I deployed to Saudi as a young one, deployed to Oman, as you mentioned, our missions would be anywhere from 12 to 20 hours long. And so you learned a battle rhythm there.
Now, as recent as your accession to the Air Force has been, as young as you still are, you've still seen a lot. Because when you joined the Air Force, we were just operating our first stealth aircraft. Mm-hmm. And cruise missiles were a new thing. Mm-hmm. And we hadn't yet seen all the laser-guided bomb accomplishments of Operation Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. And Desert Storm itself was only 10% smart bombs, 90% dumb bombs by total tonnage. Mm-hmm. Now we're at an Air Force where those percentages have reversed or even more, mm-hmm. where we have a large number of stealth aircraft, mm-hmm. where we have laser-guided bombs, GPS-guided bombs, where we also understand the limitations of these things, because you got to know where the target is before you can aim even a beautiful weapon at it and precise weapon. Mm-hmm. And so in counterinsurgency warfare, we've seen the limitations as well. We've got all sorts of unmanned aerial systems out there. I just wondered, from your point of view, what's been the most striking change in air combat over that period and that career?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the thing that I've been amazed about, if you go back and look at Desert Shield and Desert Storm, which the Air Force has been in the desert since 1991, we haven't left, or in the Middle East, and you look at the way that we fought in Desert Storm, you know, it was how do we deconflict everybody's forces to ensure they get to the target, versus if you look at now, we work very hard on integration. You know, how do we complement each other? How do we try to make sure that whatever the capability we need, we can integrate it into the total force? And to include, you know, where do we use drones? How do we use non-kinetics? You know, all of that. So I think the joint fight has grown tremendously. And I think, to me, in a warfare scenario, it's the joint fight that has really taken shape. And I think that's been so beneficial. You know, when you can go overseas and you work with your joint brothers and sisters, and then you come back and you see them someplace else, you know each other. You know, it's not all of a sudden you're walking into a building and you can't, you know, who's that? But when it starts there, you know, now you've been to the desert together, you've been to Afghanistan together, you've been to Iraq together, wherever. But you've got this common background, and I think, as I've watched that over time, I think it's been a very positive thing for not just warfare, but for the Department of Defense.
And we'll come back to, in a couple of minutes, talk about the application of these capabilities in today's security environment and some of what you've seen with dealing with China in the Pacific and North Korea at Northern Command. But first, I did want to come back to the question of the state of the military today, and specifically the question of gender integration and diversity. And I guess I'm going to ask you two questions, one about whether the glass is half full or half empty, and then regardless, I'm sure there's a lot more that you would suggest the military can do to improve. Because when I look at it, okay, you are one of roughly a half dozen women now who have reached the rank of 4-star, which is great, but I've also had it explained to me there aren't that many in the pipeline coming after you all, and we may not have another woman 4-star after, I think it's General Miller, who's still today in service, but this may be a blip, at least for a while. And then it's about 15% of all military personnel today who are women, which is a lot more than it used to be, but obviously nowhere near 50%. I'm not sure if 50% is even the correct goal. Yeah. But I guess most of all, what I wonder about is I still see a lot of reports of sexual mistreatment and abuse in the military, and that's true across our whole society, so I don't want to pick on the armed forces specifically. But I see those trends continue to get a lot of headlines and cause a lot of concern, rightly so. So I guess, again, in light of your own story and of what you see in today's armed forces, is the glass half full or half empty? And then after we talk about that, you know, I'd love to hear a couple of your suggestions for how the military can do better by women.
Yeah. So I think the glass is at half. Here's the positive things. You know, they've opened up all the jobs you can do in the military to women. You can't ask for that. The military is a meritocracy. You know, I did a speech and I talked about a lieutenant is a lieutenant is a lieutenant when you raise your right hand. You know, and I think from that perspective, that's why it's half. I think when you look at accessions, if you go to the academies, I think we're doing a great job of assessing a good percentage of women. I think the hard part comes time when people are thinking about families. Mm-hmm. And I think the hard part is, and I'll tell my story about that. My husband, as I mentioned, was a Thunderbird pilot. We were leaving Nellis, and we'd gone to Hawaii. Bummer. And it was time for us to move. And they were going to send him to Korea and me to Okinawa, Japan. And, of course, he'd gotten promoted early, so he made rank early. He was a fighter pilot. He's a fighter pilot, you know, and I'm an air battle manager. I was never going to be more than a lieutenant colonel if I was lucky, you know, and he was going to be a general officer. And I said to David, why don't I get out and you stay in and I'll follow you around and we'll do all that. Because of kids. And he looked at me as sweet as he could. And he said, and what is it you would do if you got out? And I was like, well, I don't know. And he goes, okay, you stay in, and I'll go fly for the airlines and go into the reserves. And so when it comes time to make those decisions, you know, that's the hard part is who, and it doesn't even have to be military, married to military. It can be two people that both have jobs, and, you know, how do you orchestrate all that? And so I would say it's at half. I would think we do a good job of assessing. The hard part is keeping the women in. I know I haven't touched base on this. I know that people are looking hard at that. You know, how do we do that? One of the things I would always get a lot of young ladies come and talk to me, how did you do it? And one of the things I would always tell them, the first was you have to have the hard conversation about whose career comes first whenever you don't have pressure on you. Because the second you have pressure on you, then it becomes an emotional decision and not a rational decision. And have that constantly, you know, have it every now and then. And then decide how long can you be apart? How far are you willing to live apart? What is it, you know, the long-term goals are? But do that rationally when there's no pressure. And so now David and I didn't do that. That was a lesson learned for me. I think first of all it has to be a family decision. It has to be something that is talked about. So because sometimes maybe it's the woman's career that has more potential than the man's. You know, but just have that conversation. And then I know that the services are working hard. I just saw in the NDAA they extended paternity leave, and so that's a good thing. You know, so the services are working hard on how do we make it so that, you know, we can keep, you know, keep women in. And you know, we talk about women, but I want to say it's about diversity, right? It's not just about women. It's about how do you keep different talent sitting around the table. How do you ensure you have people of different genders, different races, different backgrounds, different experiences, so that when you're the person sitting at the head of the table, that you've got a whole bunch of different voices sitting there? You know, we can talk about me as a woman, but I think the bigger story is how do we keep a diverse table? Because I think that makes you a better commander, that makes you a better decision maker when you have all those different voices telling you things that you probably hadn't even thought of or didn't even know.
I was thinking about Dave's comment, you know, what kind of civilian jobs could you do after being an air battle manager? I guess offensive coordinator for a football team, maybe. but that would probably be even more of a breakthrough on the gender front than staying in the military.
Yeah.
So I wondered, when you were talking about the difficulty that it, sort of child-raising years, and should the military do more to let people leave for 5 or 10 years and then come back at rank and still even have a future? I know there have been some efforts, but I think it's in very specialized niches.
Well, I know there is efforts, and I know that there's a program out there. I don't know the particulars, so I don't want to speak and misspeak, more importantly. But I know they're looking at that, too. I mean, I think they're trying to – how do we ensure that we have, you know, senior leader diversity at the top? You know, how do we make that path to do that? And so I know that there's programs that they have implemented a little at a very finite, but I don't know recently what other things that they've done.
And back to the point, you know, it's a tough subject, but back to the point about sexual abuse within the military is, you know, and I've sometimes wondered as father of daughters, you know, how would I feel about my daughters joining the military? And I frankly can't decide. And it makes me nervous to still see these kinds of reports. On the one hand, the fact that there is more transparency is good, mm-hmm. but the numbers don't seem to be moving in the right direction. Do you have a sense about how prevalent, you know, sexual mistreatment is in the military and whether the services are really getting focused enough on doing what they must to address the problem?
Yeah, I would say, you know, if you recall when General Welsh had his hearing to become the chief of staff, and we had just had the big problem down at Lackland Air Force Base, he took a very focused effort on sexual assault, sexual harassment, mistreatment, you know, not treating people with dignity and respect in the workplace. We had a bright shining light on that, and we have a lot of programs that are out there. I think there's a couple things that are important. So in some ways, I could tell you it's totally different than when I was in the 80s, you know, out at Nellis Air Force Base. I mean, it's just totally different. I would tell you there's been a lot of progress made. I would also tell you that the commander sets the tone. The commander is the one that sets the tone about, you know, will not tolerate. I can tell you day one on whenever I would have subordinate commanders and senior enlisted folks for their first briefing. I mean, that was one of the topics I talked about. I think it's gotten better, but I think we still have ways to go. You know, I know that we continue to deal with it, and I know we've got some wonderful programs in place. I think that, how do I want to say this? But it's a hard problem. And what you have to do is create the environment, one, that it's not tolerated, and two, the fact that then if something happens, that somebody will come tell you, and that you do create that transparency if something happens. And then three, whatever happens after, you know, something happens, you know, make sure that it's done transparently too.
One last question on the people of the military, and then I'm going to ask you a question on China and North Korea, and then finally let others share the joy and privilege here of speaking with you. But I wanted to get your overall sense about the military and society today, because we know that a lot is asked of a very small number of people. The active duty armed forces are less than 0.5% of the population, even if you add in the reservists, and again, your husband did a great deal there, and the reserve component is a huge part of our military. But even if you add in the reserves and the civilian DOD employees, still less than 1% of the population. And I'm not suggesting it should be 5 or 10%, but because it's a small fraction, that means fewer and fewer people have direct contact with the military, direct understanding of the military. Is that a problem? And if so, do you have any ideas on what we can do about it? I mean, are we seeing a greater distance between the military and the society that the military exists to protect?
So I don't consider it a problem. I just consider that we should understand that. I just retired, and my husband and I moved into a neighborhood that has no military. I mean, we're in a place that we never lived before. You know, as I stumble upon things and people, you know, we live near a military base, but you know, we're further away from it. What I realize is when you tell somebody that you were in the military, and between my husband and I, we have 73 years of service. When you tell somebody that you're in the military, the first thing they say is thank you for your service, and then they ask what you did, and so what I realize is that percentage is small. But I think that, you know, in the big scheme of things, People are grateful for what the military does for this nation. I will tell you this. I've had the privilege in the last year and a half to speak to a few civilian corporations in their leadership venues. And I always start out with, for 37 years, I supported and defended the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And you can, people sit there for a minute because, you know, it's not that it doesn't resonate with them. It's just they haven't seen somebody stand up and do that. And then I talk whatever I'm going to talk. And then at the end, I tell them I was honored to serve for 37 years to defend the United States, to do what I did so that they could do what they do because our nation needs them to do what they do. And so to me, all we have to do is continue to, you know, talk about it and not be shy. But the other thing I've been really mesmerized by, Michael, is how cities and towns embrace our warriors that have come home. And to me, that's awesome. To watch people be so proud. You know, I went to New Hampshire this fall, David and I did, and I did a Veterans Day event. And it was amazing to watch that little town in New Hampshire embrace all those veterans and say thank you to them. So I think there's, you know, there's obviously pockets, but just understand it. And to me, do outreach like, you know, that you can, and just do what we do because the nation needs us to do that.
Thank you. That's a great answer. If I could ask you about China, I wanted to go back to your next to last job in the military when you were the Air Component Commander at Pacific Command, now Indo-Pacific Command. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we talk a lot about the South China Sea and naval operations and boats and freedom of navigation operations, but you also had to think about airspace and what China was doing by way of trying to keep people out of certain air, the air defense identification zone issue, you know, trying to declare these spaces where any other country would have to alert China and sort of indirectly ask for permission to use international airspace. How do you see the overall situation there? Is it getting worse? Do you feel like we've stabilized the situation and that China now is not going to encroach further? Do you still feel like we're, you know, on a sort of a potentially delicate place where things could get worse? And what did you have to do to contend with this challenge?
Yeah, I'll tell you my experience and just a couple things about where we are now, just because I only know what I see in the news. So I took command in Hawaii, and Admiral Locklear was the commander, then PACOM, so he presided over the change of command. And in his speech, he said, this is a huge area of responsibility. 52% of the globe is the responsibility of that area. And he said 83% of that 52% is water, but 100% of that is air. And I remind everybody of that. And I always quote Admiral Locklear. I didn't say it. He did. Here's what I realized is that, first of all, logistically, to move things around the area is very difficult. It's a long ways. Just to get off Hawaii to go anywhere, it takes you 6 hours. You know, if you want to go to the West Coast, or if you want to go to, you know, Guam, you know, it's 9 hours or so to go to Japan. But the area of concern, you know, the way I thought about it, was very small. If you think about the relationship between China, Russia, North and South Korea, and Japan, and the contested islands and all that, it's small. But getting stuff there and moving stuff around is difficult. One of the things I had to deal with was, you know, folks flying. You know, we would fly around all of that stuff just as the ships, you know, did their freedom of navigation. And, you know, and making sure that we didn't do anything silly or get inside of places that we shouldn't go. I mentioned to you before I met with the Chinese air chief, and one of the things he talked about all the time was, you know, our surveillance were in places they shouldn't be. And, well, no, sir, they're actually in international waters. It's okay for them to be there. One of the things we worked on really hard was You know, how do you act in international airspace when you're going to intercept somebody? You know, as you're intercepting somebody, you know, who does what? And I had a whole bunch of folks working with the Chinese on that, as well as people at the Pentagon and all that. And we worked our way through that a lot. And I think that that was very helpful. I think the thing that as I watched my time there, I watched China going from being, defensive in nature, worrying about the mainland versus, you know, continuing to move out and do more stuff further out and then begin joint operations. I know they've continued to work on some of that stuff. I know they continue to defend those islands. And so it was different to watch. I think the thing we have to think about is they're in this for the long game. They're in this for the long game. And we need to understand that, that this is something that they're going to just continue to work on over and over again.
Does your gut tell you that we can sort of probably work it out with China? In other words, if we are smart and resolute, and a lot of the things that you're saying are going to be challenging over the long haul, that we should be able to reach a new modus vivendi where China gradually becomes another superpower and wants to flex its muscle, but we can push back in the right ways with our allies in such a way that their greater ambitions, their more dangerous ambitions, are curbed? Or do you feel that worsening rivalry and maybe even the potential for war is almost an inevitability?
Well, I don't want to get into, the diplomat's role. As Secretary Mattis used to tell us, you know, let the State Department do what the State Department does and let the diplomats do and make sure that we provide that military capability to them. So, you know, not being in those talks and not being on that, I'd be speculating, and I don't think that's fair. But I think what is important to understand is what we do as a military is to make sure whenever we're asked to do, we're ready to go.
So you're agnostic, sort of, essentially. Yeah.
Very.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people aren't, including in the military.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important we keep having this debate on China. So
yep.
I appreciate your observations. One last question for me on North Korea, and then I will invite others to weigh in. This is going to be a question that you're not going to be able to completely answer, I'm sure, for two reasons. One, no one knows the answer. And two, some of what you know is classified. But I'm going to ask it anyway, because it's about North Korea's potential missile threat to the United States. And that was your job to think about and worry about and potentially address back in 2016 to 18. My own, I'm just going to throw this out and see if you want to take pot shots at what I propose. My own view is that North Korea is probably not yet in a place where they can mount a confident ICBM threat to North America for the following reasons. They would presumably not do this out of the blue. And if it's in a crisis or a wartime situation, we're probably going to do our best to make sure the missile's not even launched, since right now, at least, given the current state of technology, they're long-range rockets, are liquid fuel, they have to be fueled on the launch pad. We have a good chance of seeing that before the process is complete. Second, even if they launch it, they haven't done enough tests to really know how well their reentry technology is going to work. So the missile could either go to the wrong place or the warhead could essentially fail on descent. Three, we do have the mid-course interceptor system that you would have been responsible for operating along with the sensor network. And I think you shared the responsibilities for some of that with Strategic Command, but the overall approach of defending the homeland was certainly ultimately yours. And those systems, while they're not perfect, have done better in testing over the years. So North Korea would have to get through that multiple-step process of getting the missile off the launch pad, having the reentry vehicle work when they've only done three ICBM tests in their history, and none of them have really tested, you know, a warhead on the way down, thank God, and then finally get through our mid-course interceptor system. So I would tend to think the odds are with us, and that the odds are pretty high that North Korea probably can't attack an American city today with any high confidence of success. But I would love to see if you have any comment on any of that to the extent you're willing.
No. Just kidding. So let me just say this. First of all, for about, this time that Kim Jong-un did 23 shots in 17, every time we got indications and warnings that he was going to do something, I had to make the assumption that it was going to hit the United States. I had to make that assumption every single time. I couldn't assume that he wasn't going to make it. Secondly, I testified to this, that I had confidence in our capability to defend the United States. Thirdly, what I would say in addressing all of that is that every time he tests, he's testing. And, you know, we get concerned about failure, and you can often learn more in failure than you can in success. Mm. And so, you know, as I've been watching in the news, in my time there, being a part of a very elaborate capability, we watched him get better. You know, we watched him be able to do things. I couldn't give you, I can tell you this. First of all, the training that happens to defend the homeland is awesome. The things that we did to make sure that the homeland was defended throughout the, the network of capabilities was constantly being looked at. And we all assumed that it was going to hit the homeland, and we all think that every time he tests, he's gaining capability.
Thank you. Very helpful answer. Well, please, if you can, wait for a microphone, identify yourself, and then pose a question to General Robinson. We'll start here in the seventh row, the woman in the light tan jacket, please.
Thank you so much. Connie Kim from Voice of America. I just want to follow up on the North Korea question that Michael just asked. So we are seeing threats that North Korea is going to give a Christmas present to the United States amid the escalating tensions right now. I was wondering what comments you had on that. And I was wondering, since you were there in the military serving from 2016 to 18, are we going to return to the fire and fury again in the next year?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to comment that because I'm not in there anymore. I'm not in the military. But secondly, I got lost in your fire and fury. Go to the first part again. I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't know. You know, again, I've read in the news a little bit. I know that the Pacific Air Force's commander was just here, and he mentioned they were watching. Obviously, we listened to the president say that they're watching. I think everybody's paying attention to what's happening. And again, I have all faith and confidence that whatever happens, you know, we'll be able to defend the United States. But I just know what we see in the news.
We'll go to the gentleman here in the black jacket, the fourth row, right there. Yep. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, General, for very fascinating remarks. My question is that earlier this year, the U.S. Study Center of the University of Sydney released a report, and they concluded that China's capability, particularly its access area denial capabilities, have developed to the extent that it has undermined U.S. ability to project power in the Indo-Pacific. What is your view on that report?
So I would say this. Last I was in the Pacific and we practiced and we talked about this. So, you know, my information is dated, so please forgive me for that. But I think that we continue to look at our ability to project power in the time and place of our choosing. And I think that, as much as they're watching us, we're watching them, and we're looking at capabilities that we can do to continue to be able to do that.
Come here to the second row, please. Gentlemen in the greenish, almost Christmas tie. Yeah.
They're candy canes.
Oh, very nice. Candy canes.
I like the candy canes.
Hi, Carl Golovin, retired Special Agent, U.S. Customs. I was a 9/11 responder. This is, in a sense, a follow-up to a question I asked of General Dunford, Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff here during the summer. You mentioned transparency. As a 9/11 responder, I would point to the work of AE911Truth.org, which has pointed out anomalies in the evidence of what happened, especially at the trade centers on 9/11. Also, the writings of Dr. Alan Sabrowski, formerly of the Army War College. Will Brookings and you in your capacity, especially with your background from the Air Force, can Brookings be a venue for exploring anomalies in what happened on 9/11 as we approach the 20th anniversary? so we can really achieve transparency regarding what happened that day.
Yeah. So I'm never going to speak for Brookings, but I think they have, you know, and I'd ask Michael to comment on this, but the amount of capacity they have here, and my experience when I was here, you know, I had the privilege to stop and think, which you don't get that privilege to do very often. And what I was mesmerized about my time here was the wide variety of capability that's here. So I'd ask Michael to specifically go there. But any place you can sit down and think and explore is awesome.
Yeah, and I would just say briefly that the best people on terrorism at Brookings and counterterrorism include Bruce Rydell, Dan Byman, Susan Hennessy, a few other scholars. So those are some of the people that you might look for their writings in the future. Tom in the far row.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, ma'am. Good morning. My name is Tom Burke. I'm an Army FEF here at Brookings.
Yay.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you having fun?
I'm loving it. It's pretty
excellent.
And
did
great
you
colleagues.
Do? Oh, great. Excellent.
Yes, ma'am, my question, kind of building off an earlier comment that you have made, last year the Joint Staff published the Joint Concept for Integrated Campaigning, shattering that peace-war binary in favor of a competition continuum, one of the central tenets of which is this idea of competition below the threshold of armed conflict. And the idea that makes this departure from the past is this idea of joint and intergovernmental cooperation. And so my question really is, what do you believe that either the Army or our interagency intergovernmental partners need to do to actually achieve the policy goals that have been set forth to achieve our ends?
Great, thank you. So what I would say, first of all, you know, obviously that's a policy question, but what I would say, you know, these are the kind of things that any military member that's going through Brookings should take advantage of to build relationships. Because at the end of the day, it is about relationships. So to the extent that, you know, some of the courses that you have the privilege to take while you're here, you know, and you have, I'm sure you have brothers and sisters at State Department, at CSIS, at other places, build those relationships, you know. And it's those relationships that when you need them, you know, it'll come out. The thing that I recognize, we all think differently, right? I mean, you know, us military peace and people, what's the task? Okay, here's the ways we're going to accomplish it. Here's the courses of action that you've got. Make a decision. Well, not everybody thinks like that. And there's no judgment there, but it's relationships that help to be able to sit down and talk about it. So what I would tell you as you work through that and then you work through the global integration things because you need the interagency as a part of all of that, that you will be able to reach out and build a relationship, you know, and have somebody to talk to help you think through the way somebody else might be thinking through it. There's forums, of course, where we have all of us together when it comes time for big decision making. But I think, it is as important that you reach out yourself. I can't tell you, I had 5 tours in the building. And what I realized early on was that the importance of not burning any bridges, because if I'd come back to the 5th tour and I was working with the same people that I worked on with the 2nd and 3rd tour, you know, and I wasn't a team player, you know, doesn't mean that I acquiesce, but, you know, there's ways to talk about things, that it would have been a very difficult 5th tour. And so to me, that relationship, so you're here at a place where you have time to go do that, you know, do that and take advantage of that and reach out to the other fellows here at the places where they are. And you'll never know what you'll learn in 5 years.
Slightly broader point from me, I just want to give a shout out to the armed forces in general for the way they take professional military education seriously. It's something that I continue to be astounded by. You could say it's a luxury in the sense that the military is big enough that people can literally take a year out of their normal progression of responsibilities. But whether you consider it a luxury or a necessity, I think it's more the latter, because what it does is it gives the Laurie Robinsons and Jim Mattises and Tom Burks and others and Eric Reeds the ability to just learn about, for example, where is China headed? And when I'm 10 years down the road in a position of command in a crisis and I want to figure out, is this a crisis where we need to ratchet up or ratchet down or find a diplomatic way out, and the military advice is going to be crucial as a future president decides what to do. It's the ability to think back and reflect on history and on philosophy and on governmental dynamics and how decisions are made in a bureaucracy and all of that kind of sophistication, in addition to the technical military expertise, that makes our military leadership so exceptional. You know, and as I've gotten the privilege of getting to know some of these amazing Americans over the years, to see what that professional military education has done to complement their worldview is something that we really have to sustain in the armed forces. And it's not just we're lucky when they come to Brookings, but of course this happens in general across the armed forces for people as they want to envision higher rank and joint service. So let's go to another question if we could, please. Start here in the front row and then over there to the third row.
Hi. If you were to look...
Identify yourself, please.
Sorry, Chris McCray. So if you were to look 10 years forward in terms of technology, is there one biggest thing that might go right or wrong in terms of technology? I mean, we hear of all these things like, you know, the computer's just been tested by Google that can do 10,000 years analysis in 10 seconds. but it's hard to sort of... Yeah. Understand exactly where all of this is going, right. And it'd be nice to have a positive scenario. Maybe.
Well, hasn't everything been positive today? Yeah, I'm teasing. So what I would say, one of the things that I know, and I can only speak really for the Air Force, but some of the joint fight, again, as I'm reading, I think people are trying to look, you know, what do we think it's going to look like out in 2025, 2030, and what capabilities do we have today, and what do we need to work on to do that, and how do we, you know, you heard the talk about just the capstone document on joint warfare, how do we envision we're going to work together to defend the nation or do what the National Command Authority asks us to do. So, I don't think there's one big thing, but I think there's a lot of things that people are working on to go, hey, this is the way it's going to be based on what we know out there. I think the thing that we work on really hard is how do we make things faster? You know, because if you look at the Googles or the Apples or the Microsofts or those kind of folks, you know, I'm always impressed by how quick, you know, they have new capability. So how can we do that in the military to ensure that we can do the things that the nation asks us to do?
Right here in the third row, please.
Thank you, ma'am. Vivian Mashi with Defense Daily. Thank you for being here. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you the Space Force question now that you're out of uniform, and all but one of the bills essentially has been passed to allow it to happen next mm-hmm. year. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about how the Space Force, you anticipate it benefiting NORAD, NORTHCOM, you know, the leadership roles that you have, and do you regret that you are not in the military right now to see it
Can I answer
happen?
The second question? No.
Both of them, but you can go with yeah. that first.
So,
thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. So not having been involved in the dialogue, and not, and again, I don't want to say something that I don't know anything about. So I wasn't involved in all the dialogue because I was out in a joint job. You know, I know General Jay Raymond, and you know, when we've made him in charge, I would tell you that was the best pick our nation could do. And so what I would tell you is, watching him do his job, I know he's going to do the best he can as he tries to shape all this, and how does he integrate that, and what do we do with that? I don't know enough specifics to give you an intellectual answer. And no, I'm very happy to be retired. It's you know, 37 years is a long time. I tell people this, though. I enjoyed every single second of it. I was so blessed with great mentors, great friends, great jobs, people that believed in me, independent of what I did for a living, and put me in places because they saw potential. I can't imagine anything better. But I'm happy to be retired. The one thing I miss is the people. I miss the people.
My friend here in the white sweater.
General Robinson, thank you very much for a very good presentation.
Please introduce yourself, even though I know you. Please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Elliot Hurwitz, and I'm retired. I worked in the State Department during the prevalence of the dual use principle, and I would like to have your thank you for a very good presentation. I would like to have your comments on the diversion of technology development from the from government sources to corporate sources, and what the implications of that are internationally.
Wow. Let me make sure I understand your question. So you, because we have corporations on, and I'll use an Air Force example, like Lockheed Martin makes a lot of our airplanes.
Yes.
Okay, and so since they do that, what is the implications of that? And then what does that do to us internationally?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Formerly, technology development was the realm of governments. Mm.
So what I would say, one, we haven't finished in the military. We still do a lot of research and development. So we have a lot of that still going on. To have the corporations, if you recall, when I was a young one in the military, we had four or five different companies that made airplanes. And so that is not new news. What's interesting about it, especially if you look at the F-35 and you look at the consortium of countries that participated in the beginning of that, you know, and the ability for us to be interoperable around the world because we understand each other. It's the same with the F-16. We have F-16s around the world. Our ability to work together, it increases that capability, and we know the capability of all that, all those other airplanes. So I think in a positive vein, I think it's good. One, we've got somebody that's focused on building stuff, and we have some R&D, and we can work together with industry. And two, the fact that we can deploy it around the world, I think, helps us in the long haul, because if we ever have to go and defend the nation or defend something else, we're not going to do it by ourselves. We're going to do it with other folks. And so to the extent that, you know, we can start with interoperability at the beginning with like capabilities, I think is very helpful.
We have time for one or two more questions. We'll go to my good friend from the Japanese Air Force is here first, and then maybe up to the
Thank you, Mike. I'm Kaneru Mizuyura. I'm just in the mic team here in the military fields. I'm background in the F-15, but I fly in the Okinawa, Japan.
Yay!
Yeah, thank you. So today's talking in the Japan is the last year's finally that we built up to the female women fighter pilot.
Yay!
Yeah. I was conveyed to pass to the Japan your today talking today's. So my question is regarding the air battle management, regarding the emerging technologies such as AIs. How do you come? I'd like to ask you your comment. Regarding the adapt the AI to the air battle management. Mm. Thank you.
So first of all, when I was the commander in the Pacific, my good friend Saito-san, we had the opportunity to spend, my husband and I had an opportunity to spend a lot of time with him. I just saw him a couple of months ago here in Washington, D.C. He was he's a wonderful person, and I enjoyed working with him. So AI and air battle management, you'll have to show me about the capability of AI to make a decision. You know, one of the things, and obviously it's supposed to be a learning machine, right? So the more you work, the more it learns. Because when you're sitting up there in an E3 as an example, there are times that the situation isn't exactly what we thought it was going to be. So the human interface to that machine and the human voice to whatever's happening out there is very time critical, time sensitive. Do I ever think it's not going to happen? No. I you know, as we watch AI develop and progress, I think that, you know, there's a, you know, it, the way we're moving forward, I can see it. Do I think anytime soon? Probably not. I think what's important is, and one of the things our Chief of Staff of the Air Force is talking about, and you probably see, is this connectivity between the force. I think that's where we need to get to, and then kind of work on that as we continue to develop and understand all the capabilities of AI.
By the way, a little advance advertisement for my good friend Tom Stefanik's book. He's working on AI and warfare, a book that we hope will come out roughly in the next year or so. And he's going to try to, I think, put it in perspective and maybe slightly deflate the hyperbole around AI without poo-pooing the future at all, but nonetheless recognizing that it's not the be-all and end-all of everything. Is that a fair summary? Gentlemen here in the fourth row, please. And it's just time for one or two more, and we'll wrap up.
Good morning. I'm Alexander with Senator Murkowski's office from Alaska. Something that we haven't talked something we haven't talked much about today is the Arctic and Alaska, and obviously that was something that was a big focus for you. Right now we're looking with General O'Shaughnessy and what the future of NORAD NORTHCOM is going to be, especially when we look at the dew line and early warning. But I'm curious what your perspective is on how much we should be focusing on the Arctic, how much should we be focusing on integrating it with not just Canada, and how much should we be really focusing on it being either a NORTHCOM issue, an Indo-PACOM issue, or a UCOM issue, because that's something that we're dealing with right,
right
now.
Right. Well, please tell the Senator I said hello. I have huge respect for her. When I testified for my confirmation hearing, I think it was Senator Sullivan that put the map down in front of General Scaparotti and I, remember, and said, you have to fix this problem, right? I would tell you a couple things. I know in my time, and I'm sure General O'Shaughnessy has taken it leaps and bounds, we worked hard on that to make sure that there was no seams between us and that the talking between all of us was consistent and the things that we thought needed to be done were consistent. I think that, you know, when you look at, I don't know how we can say it can't be just a Canada problem. It's an Alaska and Canada problem. It's a North America problem, really, is the way I think about it. And when I think about, you know, the things that NORTHCOM was doing as we were getting ready to do more exercises, to understand more in the Arctic, you know, and we look, I know my first summer there was the first time we had a cruise ship go through in the summer. And, you know, that kind of opened everybody's eyes. And so I think we have to be very sensitive to it. And I think we have to understand what's going on. You know, what are the Russians doing? What are the Chinese doing? You know, what is our capability? And then, you know, what can we invest to ensure that we can detect and take care of things at ranges that we might need to? And that's kind of the dew line and, you know, rebuilding some of that. I'm sure General O'Shaughnessy has gone leaps and bounds in front of me. I know he's got the right sight picture about that, but I think we do have to pay attention and we have to understand the environment. One of the things I used to say all the time was, you know, we've had our feet in the sand for years and years, and now we need to start thinking about putting our toe in the snow. And so I think, we worked hard. But I know General O'Shaughnessy is really working hard at all of that, too. And I know that the collaboration between UCOM, Indo-PACOM, and NORTHCOM is tight, just knowing the individuals that are involved. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Let's see if we can do one last question, and then we'll wrap up. Let's see. And we just have one more. So,
gentlemen
over here. Perfect.
I'm Kevin Lee from the Allied School of International Affairs. I have two questions. First question is that...
He said just one.
Oh, sorry.
No, I'm teasing.
TV can combine it into one.
No, it's okay.
A few months ago, Russia tested their new Pioneer hypersonic weapon. So ASP can reach the 20 Mach. As far as I know, U.S. have no the similar hypersonic weapon that has a similar capability with the Pioneer missile. So and Russia claimed that it's not deterrable and also not interceptable for the NORAD. Since you have commanded the NORAD, so I'd like to you to have some comments on it. Do you think is not interceptable at all, or our missile defense system and also NORAD can have some capability to intercept it and also deter it?
So here's what I would say. As I was leaving the department, this was a very hot topic. And I know that they are working very hard on understanding what they saw in Russia and what they perceive the capabilities will be, and as importantly, what can we do to defend the United States. I don't have fidelity data on that, but I know that that is something that people are paying attention to and making sure that we continue to work on defending the United States. So,
it is worth noting, by the way, that a lot of hypersonic weaponry becomes maneuverable only in the terminal phase as it reenters the atmosphere. And so some kinds of hypersonics could be addressed through a mid-course system like the one we have now. But I think you're right. That's part of why the Missile Defense Agency has a $10 billion a year budget for developing new technology. Because in closing, let me just say very briefly, it's the end of the year, and so I'm a little nostalgic, and I want to reflect on the amazing women that we've been blessed to know at Brookings. And four stand out. Of course, I'm going to finish with Lori and ask you to join me in thanking her. But first, Alice Rivlin, the maybe greatest of all at Brookings historically, who we lost this year after an amazing life and career at age 88. And she came back to Brookings at about age 72 after a long stint in government and, among other things, fixed D.C.'s finances during that last 16-year stint with some help from others. But was just one of the greatest of all time. And then Jan Nolan, who also had been a pioneer in dealing with nuclear strategy and a lot of Air Force issues as well. And then, of course, a woman still very much with us that we're all very proud of these days, Fiona Hill, you may have heard of. I've just recently ordered my Fiona Hill T-shirts. There's not an action figure yet that I'm aware of, but hopefully pretty soon. And finally, you know, just an amazing friend and American. Please join me in thanking General Lori Robinson.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.